Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm really glad you could join me here for a little cardboard conversation as we talk classic cardboard stuff from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and yes, even the junk from the 80s and 90s. We've covered all here on Wax Ecstatic, and we're going to cover a lot today. We've got in our spotlight 87 Fleer, as I had a couple of bargain bin goodies at the recent card show that I went to, and it's not quite a box of 92 tops for $7, but I did get a couple of 87 Fleer cellos for $1 a piece. And really, at that price, I mean, why not? So, added that to the list of bargain stuff that I picked up, and we'll tell you more about that find. And we did have a good find after a little bit of a dupe scare. I almost had a complete duplicate of a cello pack that had not too many stars in it to begin with. But fortunately, after you got through the dupe cards, there were about 8 or 10 of them. We finally hit a good one in the pack here that certainly made up for the cost of the pack itself. But we will discuss 87 Fleer, the cards that we found in it. We'll pick out 5 cards from those 2 packs, talk about the players to catch up on the whereabouts of some of those players more than 30 years later. And also why 87 Fleer, it's one of my favorite sets, not only because it was during that great stretch of sets that Fleer put out in the mid-80s, but also there is a unique characteristic to 87 Fleer that new listeners to the podcast may not be aware of. Now, if you're a longtime listener and you heard my first podcast on 87 Fleer a couple years ago, where our spotlight card was a Kent Tekulve card, if you listened to that, you already know what I'm talking about. If you watched the video link from the pack break, near the end of the video link, I point out some of the unique things about 87 Fleer. And we'll get into detail on that. And it's not just a visual thing on the front that I talk about, but I also want to key you in on some things on the back of the card that made 87 Fleer very, very forward-thinking. And really, baseball cards were not that forward-thinking until Upper Deck came around in 1989. And as we all know, premium cards and then, you know, premium style base sets started making their way into the hobby in the early 90s. But Fleer, with some innovations in photography and design and statistics, all making an appearance in the 87 set. So we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Plus some other flea market finds. Had some interesting cards that I found in the $3 for $5 bin. And also the $4 for $1 bin. I got a great story about that. So that's coming up in just a little bit. Also, we're going to talk about some of your early memories of card collecting. We got a few more people who responded to that question that I threw out there a couple of shows ago. So we'll get to all that in just a moment. First, a little housekeeping. As you know, Wax Ecstatic during the off season comes your way every other Friday. So our next show will be Friday, February the 8th. And I'm on the prowl for something to open. I'm on the prowl for certain cards to talk about. But I have a round in the chamber, also picked up at the bargain bin in the baseball card flea market. I do have an unopened rack pack of 89 Bowman. Now, I actually have a soft spot for 89 Bowman, and again, if you listen to the original 89 Bowman podcast from a while back, you'll understand why. If not, I'll save you all the details just in case we have a show dedicated to that pack break. But I know a lot of collectors don't like 89 Bowman, and for good reasons. But I do have that at the ready. And I'm going to use the Oral Roberts approach to fundraising here. As I said, I'm on the prowl. I've got some sources and resources to get some different types of cards that we can open together and discuss on the program. But if you would like for me to avoid opening the 89 Bowman Rack Pack in the next show, may you consider a small cash donation to our Wax Ecstatic tip jar, if you will, at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I know I call this the Oral Roberts approach. Other people may call it extortion. Call it what you may. But even if you donate just $2 or $3 or $5, it goes right back into the program. One, to take care of our home base at audioboom.com and all the various channels that host this show. It also maintains our archive, our shows on demand that you can listen to. So that's where the money goes. But also the money goes back into the purchases of packs and boxes and single cards and some other fun things that we open up on the show and discuss. So if you have a few dollars left over, if you survive the holidays and the family is out, and you know, maybe you live in the northern states and you've been snowed in, and you've already bought your bread and your milk and your cards, and you would like to make a donation, even if it is just a few dollars, it's greatly appreciated. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic, the best way to go about doing that. And we'll see you know, what we pull together, because I do have some ideas of items that we want to open up here, but have yet to attain them, and we're going to work on doing that over the next couple of weeks. Also, if you follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, you know about all the talk that goes on there at various points of time. If you don't follow us, please do. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter feed. It's open 24/7. If you have any questions about the hobby, if you have any cards that you want to share, and we do have listeners who do that, they'll open up a few packs and share their finds with us, and that's awesome. If you have any questions about the program, or about the sets we talk about, or you just have any general comments you want to make, you can do so at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Now, speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, like I said, I got a few early memories I want to share with you from our listeners, but I do have a very good point from one of our newer listeners, and he is a big fan of the program, talking about William King the second, or excuse me, the third. This is where I need to double check on my contact lenses here, because if you know, if you're William King the second, why not call yourself William King Jr.? But William King the third brings up a great point here about you know, being a new fan of the show, and he says, "So awesome to see here a new episode, but is there a way to download your new episodes now? I had downloaded every single prior episode, as I don't have a device that streams." And he puts in parentheses, "Hey, some of us collectors are still stuck in the ghetto, LOL." Whether you're in the ghetto or not, William King III, I did a little research here, and I was not aware that Audio Boom no longer gives listeners the download option, which, quite honestly, is just really stupid. It really is. Why wouldn't you want listeners of a podcast to download it? Yes, streaming is the big thing, and that's actually part of my day job. I work a lot in audio streaming, and I love when people, you know, click play on an audio link and listen to as much as they can stand. And you can pause and play, you know, on a mobile device or a laptop, or, you know, whatever you're listening to. You can do it that way as well. But yeah, if you want to download the episode and hang on to it yourself, or put it in a folder and you're playing it back on a Windows Media Player or something like that, it kind of stinks that you don't have that option. So I did a little research, and I shared this on Wax and Gum Stains, but I want to share this with our listeners. If you're looking to take our feed at Audio Boom, which is the link that we send out, you know, we host it at Audio Boom, and then, you know, we take that link and put it out there. And again, if you're listening on iTunes or Spotify or iHeartRadio, whatever, you know, as long as you subscribe to the RSS feed, you'll get them every time that they go up. But if you're somebody who wants to go to the Audio Boom feed and download the show, all you need to do is click on the link, and it'll open up on your computer, and go to the HTML code at the top in your browser. At the very end, type in .mp3. Again, that's .mp3. Hit enter. And what will happen is the HTML, the streaming file, will then be offered to download into your computer as an MP3 file. So, you know, William, I'm really glad that you brought that up because, again, I was totally unaware that that was an issue. It is something that when the show started, Audio Boom had the download option right there on every episode. Now that's not the case, but we do have a workaround for it. And Audio Boom, you know, I'm paying you good money to host this show. Why don't you bring back the download button? It's just really stupid to not have a download button with a podcast because that's the whole point of a podcast. You know, I would love for people to, as soon as they find out there's a new show, to just click play and listen from start to finish. But the way podcasts work, you download it and you listen to as much as you want, whenever the hell you want to. So not having a download button is just plain dumb. Some of the stories that you shared with us, kind of a mini mailbag, if you will. Again, a couple weeks ago, I threw out the question, what are your first memories of collecting? And it's not necessarily the best memory, or it's not the first card you bought or the first big hit you got, although that could be part of the story. But just when you think back to the first days or weeks that you started collecting cards, and we shared a few stories and we have a few more, starting with Steve, Wax Pack 916. He says, my earliest collecting memories were opening 88 and 89 Topps packs. I would sort them by teams and store them in a locker like this. And he includes a picture of the locker. It also had team logo stickers from Fleer packs. And that's one of the beauties of Fleer logo stickers, right? You can stick them everywhere. And do you remember those lockers? You know, by the time the late 80s came around, a lot of collectors, you know, didn't like the lockers because it didn't necessarily protect the card. It gave them a place to go. But that's when everybody was putting them in the, you know, snugly fitting cardboard boxes and, of course, the plastic pages and the top loaders. But I remember the lockers. They were plastic lockers, and they had, well, back then they would have had 24 shelves because that's how many teams, or no, 26 shelves. And, you know, basically you could buy the lockers. Like there were some stores that just sold these plastic lockers. Or I think that was one of those gimmicky gifts that you could purchase that was advertised on the side, on the flaps of Topps wax packs. So wherever you got it, though, I remember these. You would just open up this little locker, and it was probably, it was about shoebox size. It was maybe 12 to 14 inches tall, probably about 6 to 8 inches wide. And you opened up the two little doors, and you had these 26 shelves. And you had a sticker for each team that you put on each shelf. And that's where you kept the cards, and you could organize them that way. So, I remember those. I didn't have one. I actually, you know what's funny? Because I collected so many cards, I just had tons and tons of these, you know, collecting boxes, the white cardboard boxes. And I remember that I had a catalog to a card supply company, and they advertised this thing called the Box Vault. And basically, it was a giant cardboard box with shelves in it where you put your smaller cardboard boxes in. And I forget how much they cost, but I remember, you know, and this is, again, about 30 years ago, they were a little out of my budget. You know, I just couldn't spend, I don't know what it was, $20 for a cardboard box. It just didn't make much sense. So sharing off my intellect and a little bit of the DNA my father passed down with his engineering skills, took large empty cardboard boxes that I just found in my garage, and I would cut the flaps off the box with a whole lot of packaging tape. I would put the flaps inside the box and tape them to the back so I would create these shelves. And then I would stack the boxes in there. Now, a lot depended on the boxes on the bottom row. You know, they still kind of acted as a base because no matter how much packaging tape I put on these cardboard flaps, they were only going to hold so much weight. But I remember I eventually built like three of these cardboard box vaults out of just spare boxes to hold all my cards there. So it's funny you bring up the locker, Steve, because I remember the card vault and you know, being a teenager and not wanting to spend $20 or whatever it was just on a cardboard box. I just went out and made my own. And I remember that. All right, let's see. Kevmo K, 21. Back in 1968, I would look out my front window and see my grandfather walking up the driveway with a pack of cards in his hand. I remember being absolutely intrigued by the 68 set, later sitting on the porch with a neighbor friend in first grade. And that's cool. And the 68 set, if you listen back to our podcast on the 1968 top set, and, you know, that may actually be something that I do, you know, with some of the upcoming shows here, you know, as I await for the perfect wax to fall into my lap. But I have purchased, over several different lot purchases over the past few years, I would say probably about 500 or 600 cards from the 60s and 70s, and most of them are from the mid to late 70s, but there were some from the 60s. And, you know, maybe I could just grab a handful of these cards and we could just kind of talk about some of these individual sets. But, you know, 68 Tops, and I mentioned this in that podcast, it's to me, 1968 being the historical year that it was, and, you know, we just passed the 50th anniversary of 1968, and of course there's a lot of strife in America right now, and there were a lot of comparisons of what was happening during 2018 to 1968. But you know, my story with that is, several years ago I was reading Walter Cronkite's biography, not his autobiography, but an authorized biography. And of course, 1968 was a big year for Walter Cronkite. And I just happened to order a lot of cards from the mid to late 60s, and I get them in the mail, and I'm going through them, and there's probably about 20 or 25 cards from 1968. And, you know, just kind of looking at them and holding them and smelling them and you know, inspecting them and thinking back. Now, I wasn't alive in 1968, but thinking back to everything that I've read, seen, heard, know about 1968, and the fact that this lot of cards came in right at the exact time as I'm reading about Walter Cronkite's experiences in 1968. And he was certainly a big part of the timeline that year. It kind of brought it all together in a very weird cosmic kind of way. But it was cool that it did. And I have always loved the 68 set, the 2017 Topps Heritage set, which was designed after the 1968 set, one of my absolute favorites. I spent a lot of money collecting those packs just randomly here and there. So yeah, 68 Topps is, it's not best remembered for its design. It is an easily remembered design because we like to call it the burlap sack design, and not all burlap sack designs were the same from series to series in that 1968 set, but it is memorable because of that design. It's kind of an odd design for the card, especially since Topps had a pretty basic design in 67 and 66, and they would again in 1969 and 70. But I think too, just because of the timing in American history, I think a lot of people remember that set for various reasons. And of course, you've got, you know, the Nolan Ryan rookie card, and there's, you know, a lot of other star cards from the 1960s that stand out from that set. So Kevmo K, 21, thank you so much for sharing that. By the way, congratulations to the Hall of Fame inductees that were announced earlier this week. Really no surprise. In fact, if you go back a few episodes to the Banes of Our Existence podcast where we were going through the 85 Top Cello, I was talking about you know, Harold Baines versus Tim Raines, and just predicted the outcome of the Hall of Fame candidates for this year. And I'm not going to say I totally nailed it, but I was in pretty good company because there were two obvious ones, and that, of course, Mariano Rivera and Roy Halladay. There was no surprise in my opinion that those two were going to get in. And then looking at you know, some of the other candidates who were kind of on the bubble, I felt that Edgar Martinez would get in. I've been a big advocate of him getting in, even though the knock on him is that he was a DH for much of his career. As you know, as I've said numerous times, he started as an all-star third baseman and pretty much had to become a DH to, you know, stick around in the major leagues after a bad knee injury. So, you know, he certainly made the best of the opportunity because he was a DH for, I think, 11 or 12 years afterwards and put up some very good numbers, even though he didn't go out in the field for many of the games that he played from then on out. But I sensed that Edgar Martinez would get in, and I also said that if there was a dark horse, it was kind of a coin flip between Mike Mussina and Roger Clemens. I thought maybe, you know, as there has been a softening of the steroid era players, not only Clemens, but Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and Curt Schilling, I thought that this might be the chance where Clemens gets in. Well, as it turns out, the Clemens, Bonds, McGwire group only gained a couple of percentage points. They're still in the 55 to 60% range, and you have to have 75% of the vote to get in. But it didn't surprise me that Mike Mussina got in, certainly very worthy of the award, and was part of some key matchups against the Red Sox for the Yankees in the 2003 playoff run, and of course was a draft pick and a prospect who lived up to a lot of the expectations. And, you know, I think back to 1991 when you see a lot of Mike Mussina rookie cards. You know, this was also the same time that a young man named Todd Van Poppel was heavily promoted, and people thought he was going to be the next big thing. Well, it turns out Moose was and Van Poppel wasn't. Sidebar, you know, I'm talking about the flea market baseball card show I've been to recently, and I saw an old Beckett Prospects magazine, and I remember this magazine when it first came out, and this particular issue, but I saw it at this card show. They were selling it for, I think, $4, and it just made me wince. It was a picture of Todd Van Poppel seated next to a big grinning Nolan Ryan. So one of these things is not like the other. So unfortunately, Todd Van Poppel didn't live up to the hype, certainly not to the level of Nolan Ryan by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, Mike Mussina certainly did. And congratulations to him and to Rivera and also Martinez and the family of Roy Halladay. A very, very bittersweet Hall of Fame induction for him. Let's talk a little more about some of the bargain bin finds as I was at this card show with a friend of mine. And I'll start with the four for a dollar box first. There was a dealer who is not at the card show. Now, this is a monthly card show, and they do it over a weekend, so Saturday and Sunday. And you normally see the same faces there, which is good because you strike up relationships with some of these dealers, and every now and then they'll give you a break, or they'll remember you're looking for one thing one time and they'll bring it for the next time, anticipating that you're going to be there. And I always enjoy bringing my son to these shows too, because the dealers love it when kids come to shows, and they offer him all sorts of free cards, single cards and packs and stuff like that. So it's really a nice gesture, and it makes him want to come back more and collect more as well. But there's this one collector who is not there for every show. He's there just every maybe 3 or 4 months. And he had box after box. They weren't the monster boxes. These were the ones that hold, I think, like 2,700 cards or something, 2,400. And he just had, you know, 10 or 12 of these just opened up, and a whole bunch of cards and top loaders. And they were all marked $4. And I'm going through these, and I'm finding just some real gems for me, which is, of course, mid to late 70s and early 80s, Hall of Famers or star cards, not necessarily in PSA 10 condition, but I can pick up an Andre Dawson 79 Topps card. I say that's probably a PSA 7.5 or an 8 for a quarter. Sure, sign me up. So, you know, we spend probably a good 30, 40 minutes just going row by row through all of these boxes. And I eventually pulled myself away because I honestly could have been there for 2 or 3 hours going through all these boxes. But one, my wife needed me home, and my son was kind of getting bored standing around. Two, I'm going in on a budget, and it's a very small budget. I got to stick by the budget. So I'm like, okay, I already purchased some cards over here. I got to keep it to like $5 or less at this table. Well, for $4 for $1, you can come home with a lot of cards. So, you know, I'm bringing home, like I said, the 79 Andre Dawson, 78 Dave Winfield, 81 Topps Harold Baines. Who else did I get? 77 Dave Parker. So, you know, some pretty darn good cards, again, for 25 cents. So, you know, I tell my friend, okay, I gotta go. So we get up and we go. And he texts me about 15, 20 minutes later and says, you got out on time. Some guy just showed up and bought the whole collection. So I guess somebody, you know, just quickly did the math in his head. It's like, well, $4 for $1. Okay. You know, there's 800 cards in each row. So that's $200, you know, for each row. $600 for each box, and there's 10 boxes. I don't know if he offered him $6,000. Probably said, hey, I'll give you $4,000 and I'll walk out the door, no questions. And the guy's like, sure. But he basically just told everybody, all right, hey, stop searching, buy what you've already pulled, because I've got somebody who's buying the whole collection. So I thought that was kind of insane. But hey, you know, when it comes to collecting, sometimes timing is everything. Now, at one of the other dealer tables in the 3-for-5 box, I picked up, and I'm sharing some of these pictures on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I posted them right after I posted the show. So scan back to early Friday afternoon, and you will see this in case you're not listening to the show right as it's released. I got 3 54 Bowman cards, numbered 105, 120, and 130. So card number 120 is Mel Hoderlein of the Washington Senators. Great shot of him just kind of kneeling down with Yankee Stadium in the background in the twilight. Card number 105, Sal Magley. It's got a pretty good couple of creases in the lower left-hand corner. But, you know, again, it's in the $3 for $5 cards box, so why not? But also, if you've ever read Jim Boughton's Ball 4, you know Sal Magley as the Screaming Skull in that book. And then card number 130 is Milt Bowling, pictured with the Boston Red Sox. And just some nice cards that, you know, again, have been beaten up just a little bit, but certainly have not gone through the bike spokes. So again, $3 for $5. Hey, why not? And then I know some of our listeners will enjoy this. I purchased some of the Ted Williams Fleer cards from the 1959 set that I discussed in a previous podcast, and I had kind of off the cuff called it boring, and that wasn't the right word, and one of the listeners called me out on that, and I said, well, it's boring in the sense of, you know, picture yourself as a 10-year-old boy in 1959, and you actually go out and buy this set, or, you know, packs for this set. You're looking for Ted Williams in action. You're not looking for the cards of a day in the life of Ted Williams. At least chances are you aren't. Now, this set has become quite valuable because of the day in the life cards. It is a little unusual. Also, the fact that, well, it's Teddy ballgame. So, you know, there's enough value in that, enough interest in that. But also because of the one missing card in the set, which had to get pulled after it went into circulation because it shows Ted Williams signing a contract and the Topps Baseball Card Company, which, of course, had the rights to Ted Williams' Boston Red Sox cards, says, no, you can't do that. So, you know, they pulled that card, but some got out into circulation and are very valuable. But the cards that I got, so you look on the front, and they're actually in pretty darn good shape. And again, I'm sharing these pictures at Wax and Gum Stains. And speaking of wax stains, that's the reason why they're in the 3-for-5 box, because if you look at the back, huge wax stains on all three of them. But you know what? I'm okay with that, because again, I'm getting all three of them for $5. I'm probably not going to be able to afford the usual set of the cards, even if they are in a PSA 5 or 6 condition. So I'll take this bargain as I can get it. Starting off with card number 15, 1940 Williams Licks Sophomore Jinx, which sounds kind of sexual in a way. But, you know, talking a little bit about, you know, avoiding the sophomore jinx and some of the spectacular numbers that he put up as a 21-year-old. Also, card number 16, which is part of the 1941 season. It says 1941, Williams' greatest year, and it has him in mid-swing at Fenway Park. And I thought an interesting thing about this card, and you can see it in the picture, at the bottom of the card, so for example, card number 15 says, Ted is pictured sliding into third base for a triple. So kind of a caption, a second caption on the back of the card. Well, on the back of card number 16, it says, see card number 17 for the story of how Ted came close to missing the magic 400 mark. Now, of course, we know that story now, but if you're a collector back in 1959 pulling together these cards, you know, this is the teaser. You know, this is next week on Dallas. You know, it's that kind of thing. So if you're really curious as to how Ted Williams almost didn't hit 400 back in 1941, well, now you have to track down card number 17. So I thought that was actually pretty ingenious. And then I've got the oddball card, one that some collectors may think is boring, and I will admit that this is somewhat interesting. Card number 54, it shows Ted Williams standing next to this behemoth black marlin. And it says, December 1954, fisherman Ted hooks a big one. Now, again, in 1959, you probably don't care if you're a kid. Now, if you're an adult, maybe you're interested. But if you're a kid, who cares if Ted Williams caught a fish? Of course, if you're a baseball fan now, you know how huge of a fisherman Ted Williams was. In fact, his second home, you could call it in many ways his first home, was down in the Florida Keys. But he also had a home up in Canada on a river, and he would just constantly fish. He was an expert fly fisher, and some people will say that his fishing technique helped him at the plate and vice versa. It was just something about movement of the wrist and patience and timing and hitting your right spots. So, you know, he was an avid fisherman, and that's what it says here on the back of the card here. But it also points out, again, kind of a second caption, Ted shown with his prize catch, a 1,235-pound black marlin. And this happened on December 10th, 1954 at Cabo Blanco in Peru, the eighth largest black marlin ever landed with a rod and reel. Now that goes to show you, too, the incredible strength of Ted Williams. Rod and reel, Ted Williams hauling in a fish that weighed over half a ton. And we're not just talking like a Goliath grouper, like just this big fat fish sitting in the water and you just happen to hook him. It's a black marlin. I mean, this thing moves. So kudos to Ted Williams. God bless him. You know, you see pictures of him, and even later on in his career, the man had a very chiseled physique. His upper body was in tremendously great shape for many, many years. And maybe that's what helped him stay in shape, was wrestling some of these big fish in Cabo Blanco, Peru, during his off time. But, you know, like I said, I'm not going to go out and pursue the entire set. I can't afford it. B, don't have the time to. But for those who were chiding me for chiding the Fleer set with Ted Williams, because it's not all action and adventure, and plus it was an anomaly back then to have an entire card set designated to one player, which also went against the grain, because typical card collectors wanted cards of every player that they could get, and they would just collect more of their favorite player or their favorite team. But despite this, I do have to say that these are some very interesting cards. If I find some more in the bargain bin, I may just pick them up. Wax stains on the back regardless, but at 3 for $5, again, it was something that I just couldn't turn down. So some additional 54 Bowman cards, a few of the Ted Williams set. By the way, the 75 TCMA Willie Mays card that I was going to buy, it was still in the bargain bin, but I decided to pass on it because even at half price, it still was a little overpriced for me. Maybe I'll talk the dealer down a few bucks. But I instead went for another Willie. I was able to get a 71 Topps Willie McCovey, God rest his soul, for a pretty good deal. It was half price. It was $3, and I'd say it's in remarkable shape, especially as tough as it is to keep those 71 Topps cards in remarkable shapes with the black borders. This one managed to. So, you know, you got to make sacrifices sometimes, and, well, I managed to do that. So I was able to come home with some pretty nice stuff from that show, including two 87 Fleer cello packs, which we opened yesterday. And I opened them up, and if you saw the video link, which we posted on our timeline yesterday via YouTube, if you haven't found it, either go through Wax and Gum Stains and look for it, or just go onto YouTube and just type in Wax Ecstatic 1987 Fleer Cellos, and you will end up at the video link. And the first pack I opened didn't have a whole lot, you know, some notable names, but certainly not the big names. And you're looking mostly for Barry Bonds, his rookie card, or Barry Larkin's rookie card, and then some pretty darn good rookie cards outside of those two, and that, of course, would be Will Clark and Bo Jackson. Well, I didn't get anything close to that in the first pack, so I open up the second pack, and as I'm going through the cards, about midway through the stack, I hit a Bob Kipper card. Now, Bob Kipper was just this run-of-the-mill pitcher for the Pirates in the mid-80s, and you're going, well, what is Bob Kipper? What's that matter? Well, I got a Bob Kipper card in the first pack, and we all know about sequencing, and I'm thinking, oh, great. I'm going to basically lose a bunch of cards because I'm going to have a whole bunch of duplicates here, but how many dupes was I going to have? Because I'm not sure, you know, how the 87 Fleer sheets were cut back then. So as I get to the Kipper card, I flip the next card, and it's the same as the previous pack, and the one after that, and the one after that, and the one after that. It's just like, oh, geez. So, you know, like eight cards later, we finally get a break in the dupes. All right, well, we're back to a different cycle, and there's only, I think, three cards left in the pack. I'm like, well, I hope we get something out of this. And what do you know? You get the Will Clark rookie. So, if you're just looking for a return on investment, this is the beauty of some of the packs that you can still get from the mid to late 80s in particular, and yes, even some from the early 90s, but mostly mid to late 80s, is that if you find them in the bargain bin, you can, if you hit one of these bigger cards, you're making your money back. And even if you're not looking for a return on investment, at least you're getting one of the star cards out of it. And the Will Clark card is not a PSA 10 because, as we'll discuss, some of the flaws in 87 Fleer with the blue borders, it shows wear and tear very easily. And even though this came fresh out of a pack, in 32 years of, you know, sitting in a box and being transported around here, there, and everywhere and sitting in a bargain bin at a baseball card show, you know, there is going to be just a little bit of movement of the cards and the edge of the pack, to where it does take a little bit of the perfection away from it. But still, this is a card where if I wanted to sell it, I could probably sell it easily for $4 or $5 and somebody would take it. And so, you know, if you're looking at it from a financial standpoint, then, you know, you've made your money back. But, you know, some of the other cards that were in that pack there, you've got Steve Carlton was one of them. We'll talk about him in just a little bit. I mentioned the Will Clark card as well, not Will Clark, not from Boston, Will Clark, and some other notable names, again, which we'll discuss in a little bit, like Wally Joyner and Frank Viola. So, you know, overall, not a bad find, and the Will Clark card certainly seals the deal with that. Now, 87 Fleer, as I mentioned, does have, the downside is with the dark border at the top two-thirds of the card on the front, and at the top and bottom of the backs of the cards with that white cardstock, as I mentioned, you get a little friction with some movement over time, even if the card remains in the pack. So it's very hard to pull a perfect card out of the pack that doesn't at least show a little bit of wear and tear on it. So that is one downside there. But that's pretty much it. 87 Fleer has a great design, and looking at the front, you've got the dark blue from the top that then changes gradient into white at the bottom. And at the bottom, you've got the team logo. You've got a little strip of gold across the bottom as well. And great full-color photographs. And one of the things that I talked about in the video that really makes 87 Fleer stand out, and I mentioned this in the podcast we did about the Kent Tecove random pull that we did a couple years ago, is Fleer was toying around with its photography. And keep in mind, this is when Sportsflix was up and running. And Sportsflix was very expensive to manufacture. It had a very high retail price point. And people weren't quite enamored with the whole, you know, 3D moving back and forth card. It was a fun card to collect, but there were a lot of obstacles into or that prevented Sportsflix from really being a great card. So FLIR is messing around with their photography, and they're trying to come up with some sense of 3D perspective. And they did that by very subtly positioning the head of the player, but at least the top part of the action shot, if you will, having it leak out a little bit over the front of the blue background. And I show you some examples in the video, and I think, you know, as we remind people throughout the week to tune into the podcast, I think we'll get some close-up shots of some cards to further show our point here. But you'll notice, if you haven't before, you'll notice that 9 out of 10 of these FLIR cards, if there's an action shot, often the player's head is kind of sticking out ahead of the blue background at the very top of the card. So it's a very subtle 3D effect. And as I'm going through the cards that I was pulling out of this pack, I really had a great appreciation for them. And, you know, in fact, there was one particular card, Harold Baines, speaking of Hall of Fame cards in the pack here, you know, Harold Baines, because he was with the White Sox wearing their 1986 uniform, their batting practice uniform, you had the bright red batting practice uniform and the cap that had the white crest on it with the black or the dark blue socks across the front. Well, the bright white crest of the hat in front of the blue backdrop for the card really made basically the top of Harold Baines's head pop. It just made it stand out. And I'm looking through some of these cards, I'm like, you know, I've known about this before, but now that I'm taking a second look at it, it's actually pretty impressive what FLIR was doing. And yes, it was intentional. I don't think they really called attention to it in any of their marketing, but they very quietly took a giant leap forward in the photographic presentation of players. It wasn't just a picture of a player. It was a picture coming to life. And again, it's not just because of the Sportsflix cards. It was also, if you remember, Donruss back in the mid-80s had their 3D cards, which, you know, there were three or four that came together. And basically, it was a big cardboard cutout, and you would just, you know, pop a few little slats loose, and you could have a player in action. But those were kind of big and clunky. This was very subtle, and I thought it was really, really cool. Now, on the back of the card, this was the first year that FLIR introduced some advanced statistics. And in 87 FLIR, you had the hot zones. So for pitchers, where they were most effective pitching, and for hitters, where they were most effective hitting, which was extremely brilliant. And you look back at it now, this is 1987. This is kind of, I don't want to say the beginning, but certainly the early stages of sabermetrics and advanced statistics, whether you like them or not. I mean, this was, you know, basically the very start of it. So I thought that was a very creative way of taking your standard baseball statistics, which are plastered all over the backs of cards, and breaking it down by hot zones. And you would see this in future cards where you had in 88, you had the splits, you know, day versus night, home versus away, lefty versus righty. And then in 89, you had the pre-All-Star game and the post-All-Star game. 1990, I believe you had the, it was very similar to the hot zones, you know, certain trends for each player. So, you know, some very deeper diving statistics were produced for FLIR on the backs of these cards for the next several years. I don't recall what was in the 91 FLIR because I didn't buy much 91 FLIR, as we've already discussed. And by 92, they had gotten rid of that because, again, you know, the base sets were ramped up in their design, and all of a sudden the cute little advanced statistics kind of went by the wayside, which is rather unfortunate. But I thought that was a very creative way to further explain the game. So if you have a stack of 87 FLIR cards, take a look at them front and back, and I think you will have a greater appreciation for an already impressive set that is still extremely affordable. It is kind of on the cusp of the junk wax era, depending on who you ask. Some people think it starts in 86, others say 88. Others are kind of ridiculous and they say, well, it starts in 81 when Fleer and Donruss came around, which I think is a little bit of a stretch. But for a card set that looks nice, that has some rookie star power, that has some young star power, you know, you do have young Jose Canseco in this set. You also have Roger Clemens in this set. You also have Dwight Gooden in that set as well. And all the stars from the 1980s are in the 87 FLIR set. So you've got some pretty good cards that you can pull from this at a very affordable price. Now, in my case, I was able to find a couple cello packs for $1 each. Prices vary wherever you're shopping, but you can still find lots of wax packs and rack packs and even some unopened boxes. You can easily find them for under $40 in a lot of cases. So dig a little bit, look around a little bit, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised with what you can pull from this FLIR set, not only in design, but in star power and affordability as well. What helps make the FLIR set from 1987 also easy to collect, a manageable 660 card set size, so you're not going out there and getting those giant sets like I was talking about in the early 90s. You're getting 132 cards fewer than what Topps is putting out then, but you have a nice looking compact, affordable set in FLIR. And unfortunately, because 1987 was such a good year for the baseball card hobby, of course, you had the legendary 87 Topps set released that year. You also had a very, very strong Donruss set released that year, which kind of mimicked the 85 set with the black background. I prefer the 85 over the 87. 87 had a little more of a cookie cutter feel to it, but you still had this very sharp and striking set from Donruss and your normal Donruss favorites, including the Perez Steel Diamond King cards to lead off the set and your rated rookies, which were hit or miss. But, you know, if you were somebody who chased rookies, you already had a handful of predetermined star players or players who were supposed to turn into stars. And then you have, you know, Barry Bonds and Greg Maddux and a lot of other pretty solid rookie cards there. So because you have the legendary wood grain look to the 87 Topps set, and you have a pretty sharp 87 Donruss set, 87 FLIR often gets overlooked. And this is unfortunate because this, I think, was the last really good FLIR set in their mid-80s stretch. I think FLIR was at their best from 83 to 87. With the best of the best being 84, 85, and 86. And that's not a knock against 87, but I just think they had this five-year run of just producing some incredible card sets. And when you look back to the, you know, blurry and dark pictures of the 81 FLIR set, the rather boring design of the 82 set, and even though they picked up their game in 83 and 84, you still had some photo quality issues. You know, the picture on the back of the card was neat, but, you know, it was tiny. It was black and white. It was a little more of a gimmick than anything that was really valuable to the collector. But by 1987, FLIR had it figured out. And even though I've never been a huge fan of the 88 and 89 sets, they're good but not great. You know, they're still pretty solid sets. And as I've said before, I was a huge fan then and now of the 1990 set. So this is just right in the glory days of FLIR's baseball card sets in the 1980s. So it's unfortunate that it gets overlooked so easily. But the fortunate thing is, because it gets overlooked so easily, there's still plenty of product out there and you can still get them at pretty good prices. Now, as for some of the cards that I was able to pull out of the 87 FLIR set, I'm going to add a little twist to this. I'm going to pick, for every show that we do pack breaks, I'm going to pick just 5 cards. And this has varied from show to show because sometimes I find 7 or 8 or 10 cards that are interesting. Others I find 2 or 3, but I'm going to find 5 and we'll stick with that. I was trying to come up with a cute name for it, but I just couldn't figure it out. So you assign the cute name to it. One of the cards, which if you were opening this pack in 1987 would have been an absolute winner to hit, was Wally Joyner. Of course, Wally World credited some coaching in a Puerto Rican professional baseball league for helping him with his swing, and it certainly paid off in dividends as a member of the California Angels in the early to mid-1980s. The runner-up to the American League Rookie of the Year award, he fell behind only to Jose Canseco, who in his own right at that time was just absolutely dominant. Also broke up not one, but 2 no-hit bids. Broke up Charlie Huff's no-hit bid June 16th with 1 out in the 9th, and then broke up Walt Terrell's bid with the Detroit Tigers on August 20th with 2 outs in the 9th. And he was also part of the Angels' almost miraculous run to the World Series in 1986, which came to a stunning conclusion at the hands of the Boston Red Sox in 7 games. And we all know, that story and the Donnie Moore incident and the Dave Henderson home run. I mean, it's the triumph and tragedy all in one series. And, you know, had the 86 World Series not been what it was, I think a lot more people would really see the drama that was created in the ALCS between the Red Sox and Angels. Well, after 6 years of starring with the Angels, being an all-star first baseman, contributing to not a very successful team after 86, they were competitive but not extremely successful, he would go on to sign as a free agent with the Kansas City Royals. I remember his 93 Topps card. It was this nice panoramic shot with the stadium lights of Kauffman Stadium behind him. It was a nice, clean look. But Wally Joyner couldn't get the Royals back into contention in the mid-90s. Signs on with the San Diego Padres after being traded for Bip Roberts, and he would play for the Padres for 4 years, was part of the 1998 National League Championship team that got swept by the Yankees in the World Series. And after the 1999 season, he would move on to Atlanta in a trade that sent Reggie Sanders to the Braves and Brett Boone and Ryan Klusko to the Padres. That was kind of a big deal because Klusko was one of those prospects in the Braves system for many years. Now, he would play for the Braves for a couple more years before officially retiring in 2001. He would go on to become a coach, not only with the Padres, but after a little bit of a run in there with the management and ownership, he would move on to the Phillies and later the Tigers, leaving the Tigers after the 2016 season. Very active back in Utah with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And there is a tiny bit of controversy. Yes, even with Wally World, as he had admitted to ESPN the magazine back in 2005, that he briefly used steroids. He was near the end of his career, age 36, was trying to keep his body in shape, and he asked, who else? Ken Caminiti. You know, how do you get this stuff? And he claimed that he only used them very briefly, like 3 times, and that was it. However, he has been listed in the Mitchell Report from 2007, so perhaps there was a little more use than just a couple of pills here and there. But he said he wanted to set the record straight for his children. Didn't have this dark cloud following him throughout his career, but a rather unfortunate end to a very, very successful career. In fact, when I was looking back at his stats, I'd totally forgotten his time with the Braves after the Padres. I knew he was with the Padres, but he just kept chugging along for a few years. And that's one thing to remember, too, about players who were wrapped up in the steroid era, is that often you think of it as the power hitters and you think of it as the power pitchers, but a lot of the times the players who were, there were two types of players who were actually most likely to use them. One was the 4A player, you know, the Dominican kid coming from a small, poor town, and his only ticket to fame is getting onto a major league roster. So he's going to do everything he can to get on there. And that's why, if you remember when there were all sorts of steroid punishments being handed down, and this is like 10, 15 years ago, a lot of the times it was AAA ball players, and people go, well, you're getting the minor leaguers, why not Mark McGwire or Sammy Sosa? Well, because McGwire and Sosa were smart in how they masked using this stuff, while the minor leaguers were a little more reckless and were definitely looking to boost their chances of getting into the majors. And then the other type of player was, like in Wally Joyner's case, the player who is trying to stay in the majors. So it's a very unique, diametric opposite battle going on here. The kids fighting to get in, who may use to try to increase the chances of getting in, and the players, the veteran players who are fighting to stay in, attempting to keep the jobs away from the young kids trying to get in. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Tom Brunansky, I pulled this card and noted the old Twins jersey, which of course they changed in 1987 when they won the World Series. Tom Brunansky, a member of that World Championship team, not originally with the Twins, however. He was actually drafted in the first round of the 1978 draft by the California Angels, and would get traded to the Twins early in the 1982 season in exchange for pitcher Doug Corbett and infielder Rob Wilfong. Now, while Wilfong was a key member of the Twins infield for a few years and would have a pretty decent career with the Angels, Tom Brunansky became a fixture in right field, and this guy could just smack the hell out of a baseball. He was the only Twin in franchise history to hit a grand slam inside the park home run on July 19th, 1982. What's interesting is the four runs that were scored were all unearned runs for Brewers pitcher Jerry Augustine, and that's because the Brewers made two fielding errors in the inning, eventually setting up Brunansky's grand slam. You have to remember, too, when the Metrodome opened in 1982, not only did it not have air conditioning, which is odd, but the AstroTurf was especially bouncy in 1982, and I'd say the first 5 or 6 years of its existence. The Metrodome had some very wild, lively turf, and routine ground balls were anything but. They would take all sorts of bizarre hops, skips, and jumps. So he was a member of the 1987 championship team, then surprisingly gets traded to the Cardinals in April of 1988 for second baseman Tom Hare. After a couple of years in St. Louis, he moves on to Boston in exchange for Lee Smith. Quite a good deal for both teams there, as Smith, of course, would become a legend in the closer's role in St. Louis over the next several years. And Brunansky would become a legend for the Red Sox. And I remember this game, too, late in the 1990 season. And I remember this for two reasons. One, because as a Blue Jays fan, the Jays were trying to chase down the Red Sox at the end of the season for the American League East pennant. And I remember the Chicago White Sox. They were just finishing out their last season at the old Comiskey Park. And the White Sox changed their uniforms to the uniform that they wear now, the one that became wildly popular, the black and white pinstripe, basically the type of style that they wore in the 1950s, the go-go socks. They wore that uniform for, I think, the last like 10 games of the 1990 season. Well, the White Sox are trying to rally in a game. The Red Sox are trying to win the game so that they can clinch the AL East title. And Brunansky makes this spectacular catch on an Ozzie Guillen hit into right field at Fenway Park, and that seals the deal. And in fact, the Red Sox actually memorialized that catch at Fenway Park not too long ago. He would go on to move on to the Milwaukee Brewers and eventually finishes up his career with the Boston Red Sox again. Also got into the coaching world, was a Twins hitting coach for several seasons, and fired after the 2016 season. Now, another notable name, especially with the postseason, and just a fun name to say, we pulled this from the pack, Candy Maldonado, also known as Candido Maldonado Guadarrama, born in the Dominican Republic. And of course, you better know him as, or excuse me, in Puerto Rico, my bad, born in Puerto Rico. And you know him better as Candy Maldonado. And again, as a Blue Jays fan growing up, Candy Maldonado was a member of the 1992 team. And while the Blue Jays were winning or on their way to winning the World Series, there was this Saturday Night Live sketch with Rob Schneider where he played this really annoying office clerk. And he's sitting in the copy room. I think they called it Copy Boy. I think that was the name of the sketch. And he would just, you know, like somebody would come in, you know, let's say a character named Cindy. And she would go, Cindy, 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 making copies. So, you know, and that was basically the whole shtick. There wasn't a whole lot to it. So, I don't know, being a teenager, every time I would see Candy Maldonado come up to the plate, I would go, Candy, Candy Maldonado. And it was pathetic, actually, now that I think of it. But it was also because his nickname was the Candyman. And in fact, I think that was a Chris Berman nickname. So you go, Candy Maldonado, the Candyman, making copies. Now, before he won a World Series with the Blue Jays in 1992, he was originally property of the LA Dodgers, moved on to the San Francisco Giants, has a note of infamy in his baseball biography. He lost a pop-up off the bat of Tony Pena in Game 6 of the 1987 NLCS between the Cardinals and Giants. Pena ends up getting a triple off the play. He would score on a sac fly for the only run of the game that would force a Game 7, which, of course, the Cardinals won. And the Cardinals would advance to lose in 7 games to Tom Bernanski's Minnesota Twins. Go figure. There's some other interesting notes in Candy Maldonado's career. On May 4th, 1987, he became only the 16th member of the Giants franchise to hit for the cycle. In 1994, he scored the first ever run for the Indians at Jacobs Field. And speaking of World Series heroics, he had the walk-off hit for the Blue Jays in Game 3 against Jeff Reardon, the closer for the Atlanta Braves. He also hit a pretty important home run in Game 6 of the series in Atlanta. But that was a walk-off win for the Blue Jays in Game 3. And also, in that 1992 World Series, he hit the first game-winning hit outside of the United States in World Series play. Also, what is interesting is he's the only Giant to hit a triple in the 1989 World Series. Not that triples were all that common in a four-game series sweep, but I've got all your Candy Maldonado trivia that you need. Going back to somebody who was key in the Twins' success in 1987, Sweet Music, Frank Viola, who is an absolute artist. What's funny about Frank Viola, you look at him statistically, his win-loss record is 176 to 150. He had a career earned run average of 3.73. Had 1,800-plus strikeouts. He didn't do anything great. He was not a dominating pitcher, but for the most part, he found ways to win. He was a huge asset in the Twins, winning the World Series in 1987. He had a spectacular postseason. And by the way, the Twins got lucky. He was originally drafted by the Royals in 1979, but didn't sign. So they drafted him, the Twins did, in the second round of the 1981 draft. Had a little bit of a rough start, but then became the anchor of the Twins pitching staff for the next several years. As I mentioned, had a clutch playoff performance, won Game 7 by the final score of 4-2, was the World Series MVP, had a tremendous 1988 season, 24-7 record, career low ERA of 2.64, won the Cy Young Award that year, just edged out Dennis Eckersley. But then, strangely, the Twins part ways with him. They move him to the Mets. So he's basically in his backyard where he grew up and would play for the Mets for a couple of years, left the team in 1991, couldn't agree to a deal with them. Signed with the Boston Red Sox. An interesting note here, he and another pitcher, Corey Bailey, combined on a no-hitter in spring training against the Phillies in Clearwater, April 2nd, 1993. Now, Viola would suffer through all sorts of major arm injuries and technically finish his career in 1996 as a member of the Blue Jays. Got into coaching And also his family, very active in sports. First of all, his son, Frank III, attended Florida College in Lakeland, tried to work his way up through the minor leagues, became a broadcaster instead, and then went back into the minor leagues a couple years ago. He was a member of the Blue Jays club, or the Blue Jays system, I should say. And Frank Viola also has two daughters, very active in sports, or at least they were, as daughter Brittany was an Olympic diver at the University of Miami. She competed in London in 2012. And also daughter Kaylee played volleyball at Winthrop University and is now an assistant coach at Davidson College. And our last card from the stack, lefty, Steve Carlton. I don't think we've talked about a Steve Carlton card. Steve Carlton, I mean, Hall of Fame numbers, no doubt. He got inducted with over 95% of the vote back in 1994. 329 career wins, an earned run average of 3.22, 4,136 strikeouts. There was a legendary back and forth between him and Nolan Ryan for the strikeout king title, which ultimately ended with Carlton's career in 1988 with the Twins, and Ryan, of course, would go on to play for another 5 years, topping 5,000 strikeouts. But Carlton won the World Series twice in 1967 with the Cardinals. People forget the Cardinals in 67 and 68. Bob Gibson throwing heat from the right side, and then you've got that wicked slider from Carlton on the left side. Two incredible arms and fiery personalities that the Cardinals had back then. Of course, he was a member of the 1980 World Series championship team in Philadelphia, four-time Cy Young Award winner, and is often best known for winning single-handedly 46% of the 1972 Phillies games. Because the Phillies won just 59 games that year, Carlton won 27 of them, which is just simply amazing. No wonder why he won the Cy Young Award in 1972. Also best remembered for being the better part of the Rick Wise trade. He had contract squabbles with the Cardinals ownership in the early 70s. Augie Bush says, get him out of here. So the Cardinals send him to Philadelphia for Rick Wise. And while Wise had a pretty productive career, paled in comparison to Carlton. So while at the time the trade seemed to make sense, of course, hindsight being 2020, this is often like the Nolan Ryan for Jim Fregosi trade as well. At the time, it made sense. Or do you know what? Actually, a better one, I think, is the Doyle Alexander for John Smoltz. It seemed to make sense at the time. But in the end, there was no doubt that Steve Carlton was the better of the two pitchers and certainly had a Hall of Fame career, while Rick Wise had a very good career, very lengthy career, but couldn't live up to the accomplishments that Carlton and the Phillies certainly had in the 1980s. Carlton was notoriously moody, had a personal strike with local media. In fact, went, I think, 10 or 12 years without doing interviews with local sports media. The only time that he loosened up a little bit was near the end of his career. But also, sometimes a lot of the things that he said were not very friendly. Bigotry, anti-Semite, all sorts of nasty stuff. And if you've read the book Cardboard Gods, you know that Steve Carlton was very rude to a lot of people. There's still a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth, including Josh Wilker, who is the author of Cardboard Gods. And just read that one page about the 81 top Steve Carlton card he got, and he just is venomous with his thoughts on Steve Carlton. But still, a guy who still had a few years left in the tank, despite this 1987 Fleer card. In fact, he wasn't with the White Sox in 87. He would play with Cleveland and was a teammate of fellow 300-game winner Phil Niekro, believe it or not. That's an amazing stat. So there you have it, some interesting cards, five interesting cards from our 87 Fleer Cellos. Again, 87 Fleer overlooked, but that is to your benefit, as you can still find plenty of these cards and in good shape all these years later, and not too costly as well. It's a beautiful set, and I strongly encourage you, if you don't already have a handful of 87 Fleers around, just buy some, take a look at them, open up some packs, and have some fun. You're not going to spend a whole lot of money on them, and you might even notice some of the intricacies of the advanced stats in the back or the subtle 3D photography on the front. Well, that'll do it for our show this week. Again, Wax Ecstatic will come back in 2 weeks, Friday, February the 8th. Again, I will threaten you with opening the 89 Bowman Rack Pack, or maybe that will excite you. Hey, maybe you'll be interested to see what we pull out of the 89 Bowman Rack Pack. But if not, again, we can go out and purchase packs by your donations. If you want to make a cash donation, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And Oral Roberts extortion kidding aside, if you have made donations to the program, we thank you because you not only have helped us go out and buy packs, but you've also helped us maintain the archive and the whole website, as well as we keep this podcast going throughout the off season. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for listening to Wax Ecstatic.